Okay, so we are now recording, and I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck.
And Jocelyn just made a note in the chat that there might be some missing people because on the web page we've got the ID but not the password. And that tiny URL actually has the password built into it. So if they click on that, they should get here.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got to find the share my screen. Share my screen. Pick that one, share, and everybody should be seeing my title page.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, so the first item of business is a follow-up from last time. If you remember, Chris did a demo on Fantasy Zones, and the question came up. He said that multi-monitor was supported. Oh. The question was, how do you do that with multi-monitors? And he also includes multi-desktop. So, Chris.
Yeah, so it's actually pretty slick the way it works. And so you can have different zones on different monitors if you're in a multi-monitor, or on different desktops if you're using virtual desktops. The trick to it is that you have to launch the zone editor on the screen where you want to define the zones. And so you can do that either two ways, either just make the screen active, either just by clicking on it on the mouse, whether it's multiple monitor or whether it's a virtual desktop, just make sure you click in that that desktop or that monitor. Then you can use the hotkey, which is the Win and the back tick, which is next to the left of the one key on most keyboards. The other way you can do it is if you just launch the PowerToys app from the system tray, you can then drag it to whatever monitor or whatever virtual desktop you want it, and then from within there you click on the Edit Zones button, and then when you create zones and when you apply it, it will apply to that particular monitor or that virtual desktop. The nice thing is that it seems to survive it. I'm presuming that multi-monitor will actually survive restarts as well, but I don't have a multi-monitor set up right now. But I did test it with virtual desktops. If you destroy the virtual desktop, if you actually delete it, the zones will go away with it. But if you leave the virtual desktop defined, you can even restart Windows, and it will recreate that virtual desktop, and it will recreate the zones on that particular desktop. So pretty slick. So if you're in either of those situations, yes, you can indeed have different zones on different screens.
Okay, there's a bit of background noise, so I'm going to mute all.
Oh, sorry,
and
yeah.
And then I'm going to, I hope I mute it all. Mute all. And I'm going to try and... Well, I guess co-hosts don't get muted. Okay.
Okay.
So it should be good. Okay, so the next item of business is a share, you said, hopefully. Those of you who are on the members-only forum, there's been a lot of chat in the last few days about how to send faxes using Windows 7. And in particular, the problem was a member... her general practitioner wouldn't accept email, but would accept faxes. So the question was, how do they do that? And there was quite a bit of chat, and the bottom line, or the solution, was to use this system called FaxZero, which is a web-based system. It's free for both the US and Canada, but it's limited to essentially three pages of material plus a cover sheet. There's a paid version, but the suggestion was if you needed to send six pages, just send two free ones twice. So send two free ones. And then for other people were suggesting for frequent faxing, there are month-by-month services. Or the other suggestion was just to buy a cheap fax machine or even a cheap multifunction printer. You know, that would be a printer, scanner, copier, and fax, a 4-in-1 printer. And, of course, to do that, you have to have a phone line that will carry the fax signal. So that's the kind of thing if anybody's interested in faxing. And if you're on the call and you are a member of the club, but you're not subscribed to the forum, then you're missing out. The forum is essentially... a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week question and answer session. So if you want to be, if you want to participate to see what people are saying and asking, or ask your own questions, provide information, whatever, all you have to do is send an email to this address. You don't need a subject and you don't need body text, and you'll be approved for access to the forum. And I believe you'll also receive the messages by email. Is that correct, Chris? He said, looking for Chris and
Francis. Oh, yeah, I just had to unmute myself. That looks like it's correct. See, member forum plus subscribe. Yep, that's exactly right. Yep.
And if you, I don't know whether that's in the chat window, that link. Sorry.
I can put it there.
If you go to the website, scroll to the bottom, one of the links on the bottom is the Google Groups How To. That will tell you how to get onto all of the Google Groups. Okay, so moving on again, he hopes, there we are. Somebody reports receiving pop-up ads for, which is selling McAfee's Total Protection, and they look fishy, so it looks odd. His computer is running Defender, and he also uses SOAPAS as an on-demand scanner, but he's getting the ads every couple of hours, and there's no obvious way of stopping them. His question is, shouldn't Defender have prevented the ads from popping up? And if Defender doesn't object, is the pop-up therefore trustworthy? And I think Chris has some suggestions.
First off, the idea that Defender should actually stop this, I think, is stretching things, because Defender is really anti-malware. It's not really designed to remove pop-up ads. So I wouldn't expect it ever to do that. It may in some circumstances, I suppose, if it thinks that it's truly malicious. However, one of the things I say about pop-ups that come up, Krebs's number one rule for staying safe online is, if you didn't go looking for it, don't install it. And I think this is really important. If you go to a website and you get a pop-up that says, oh, you should do the following for whatever reason, you know, for a better, richer experience on my website, or because I'm going to give you something for free, or anything at all, you didn't go to the website looking for that pop-up, don't install it. If you decide that you do want whatever it is, go to the website which will have that. So if it's popping up and telling you that you need Java, and you decide, okay, I guess I want Java for this particular website, don't install it from a pop-up on that website. Go to java.com and install it from there. The URL is there for the three rules. I think they are fantastic rules, that if people follow those three rules, they will probably eliminate about 75 to 80% of the possibility of getting compromised on various websites. I'll paste that in at the end of this particular answer for that URL. The fact is, the pop-up actually had at the bottom of it, powered by Fast! App Store. So even if you wanted it and it's trying to sell you McAfee, it obviously is not going to come from McAfee. And so it's going to come from this Fast App Store. So if you really want McAfee, I would go to the McAfee website to get it. Now, just having this doesn't necessarily mean that it's malicious. And in actual fact, I'd be willing to bet that it's the opposite. It's not malicious. The really bad guys are not going to tell you powered by Fast App Store or anything else. They're just going to make you think you're getting it from McAfee. So it's probably actually not a malicious pop-up, but regardless, I would probably still go to the McAfee website if I actually wanted to buy McAfee antivirus. And I would be willing to bet if you hovered over the click for details, which was in the pop-up, it would show something other than McAfee.com.
I would hesitate to click on any pop-up, but I think the fact that the pop-ups are occurring is a problem, and I would do something like run auto runs from sysinternals, or run ADW cleaner. I've sent the link for that. or a review of it anyway, because the pop-up should not be happening whether you're in a browser or doing other stuff.
Well, I think I agree in the sense that if it's popping up randomly, then something is causing that pop-up to happen. If it's popping up consistently when you go to a particular website, it may actually just be that website. It's really hard to tell from the amount of information that was provided in this. But, yeah, ADW Cleaner or something like that is always a good thing to run if you think that there's any possibility of something suspicious on your computer. I agree. That's a good program and may bring up something that is causing these ads to pop up.
The other thing that can stop a lot of pop-ups, I go to a fair number of computer-related websites, and everybody likes to serve up their ads and their videos and everything else. I often use JavaScript toggle it on and off. If I toggle it off, it basically stops all the pop-ups. And if it's a website that really needs JavaScript to do something I want to do, then I can just hit the button and toggle it back on again. And it's an add-on for Chromium-based web browser engines, so it works for my browser. It probably works for a lot of others, too.
Yeah, I've tried it, and one thing I will caution is it can do drastic things to some websites. All you have to do is turn off JavaScript and then go to, I think it's hollandamerica.com, and you'll get completely blank page. They do absolutely everything through JavaScript. So just be aware that on a trusted website, you may want to periodically toggle the JavaScript back on to see if you're missing things, because you may be missing a lot.
And when the website doesn't, the normal website you're used to doesn't respond the way you think, just look in the top right-hand corner and see if JavaScript isn't toggled off, because that happens to me quite a bit too.
Yeah.
You can also use uMatrix to, and for that matter, uBlock Origin to block JavaScript. And uMatrix in particular does a really nice job of managing all the links that can happen on a page, as well as managing JavaScript and other stuff like that on a very detailed basis. uBlock Origin, I've actually gone back to the defaults and left the things blank and then set it up so that it brings in all the lists of bad and adware sites as a default. And that's my, I guess that's the initial screening that my browsers do. And it's available on pretty much every browser.
Cool.
Okay, another question that came in was that Internet Explorer had just been replaced by Microsoft Edge. And the question was, is Edge better than Explorer? And what did I lose by not having Explorer? What are the benefits of Edge? And is it worthwhile to change back to Internet Explorer? And this, I think, happened recently with one of the Windows updates. And I saw this thing too, and I guess my thoughts are, does the browser that you're currently using with possibly some add-ins like JavaScript control do everything that you want? And in my case, cross-platform is very important because most of the time I use Linux. But occasionally, like tonight, I'm running Windows, and it's very convenient if I can use the same programs and on both platforms. I need a system that lets me display a page, a specific page, when I open a new tab, because I use a menu, an offline HTML page with links to all my favorite websites. So every time I click on a new page, it pops up the menu. I just click on whichever site I want to go to. I talked about being able to toggle JavaScript on and off. And also custom print a web page. I like to be able to control whether I print page two or print all 12 pages of the website. So if the answer is yes, your current browser is doing everything you want, which in my case it is, then why would I change? And my thought was just to get rid of that annoying message about Edge and not worry about it. And then Chris says, well, if the answer is no, well, try another browser because they're all free. And that's, I love free software. So I've tried a number of different browsers until I find the one that does the job for me. And Chris, have you had some other suggestions too?
Yeah, I just did a search on, you know, features unique to and whatever browser you want to look into, and that will hopefully come up with a list of things that, because a lot of people don't know, you know, what is a good browser? Why should I switch to some browser other than what I've got right now? And you may not know about some features that you could take advantage of if you do switch. So if you do something like features unique to Edge, you know, it'll come up with some web pages that highlight things that are not in other browsers, which could be interesting. So make sure the information is current because the browsers are changing on an ongoing basis. So I would say anything older than about a year old is probably next to useless in terms of features on browsers.
I would suggest getting rid of Internet Explorer, though. I use currently five browsers, and none of them are Internet Explorer.
It was
Firefox is most locked down. Brave is pretty nice. Chrome is okay. And Opera and Edge.
I wouldn't necessarily advise that people should get rid of Internet Explorer. If you're happy with it, you know, why change to something else?
I highly disagree with that. Internet Explorer should not be used unless you have a corporate reason to do so. It has got too many bugs in it, and it's too vulnerable compared to what else is available.
It's still supported by Microsoft, so...
I don't even go that far, Chris.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is 100% supported by Microsoft.
No, I don't believe so. I read something a couple years back where basically it was being depreciated, and... Even Microsoft tells you not to use Internet Explorer.
Yeah, because they've got Edge. If they didn't have Edge, they would happily tell you to stick with Internet Explorer.
Yes, Microsoft's alternatives are Microsoft's motives are well known, but in this particular case, I can't see anyone. Internet Explorer is just plain bad news, period, unless you have a corporate reason to have to use it. My opinion.
Yeah, that's fine, but I mean, it is still supported. It is still updated through the Windows update process and things like that. So I'm not religious about browsers one way or another. Well, I mean, whatever you're happy with, go with it.
Neither am I, except Internet Explorer.
Okay, some of the URLs on the screen there now. So these will get posted to the Q&A area of our website. So I found one on basic Internet browser features. It's undated. I suspect it's quite old. But it talks about the basics of tabs and things like that in browsers. So if you're really unfamiliar with features of browsers that sort of cut across all of them, that's a good link to actually give you a broad base of what is available in the browser. And then Wikipedia has a page on comparison of web browsers, so that should be always kept up to date. People are pretty good about updating Wikipedia pages, and so if you're looking about features on there, it's a very long article. And then I saw one, Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, or Safari, which browser is best, from PC Mag. So if you trust PC Mag at all, that was an interesting sort of article. And then an interesting one I came across was different web browsers create different experiences and website woes. And so that was an interesting read on there. So that was just some things that I came across as I was doing some just searches randomly on, you know, different browsers and what the capabilities are and so forth. So they may be interesting. There's lots more out there for sure. People tend to be very opinionated on browsers and either love or hate various browsers for various reasons. I suggest you try them all. So to change your default browser, if you want to change your default browser, if you press the Windows key and the I key, that'll bring up the settings dialog box, or you can just click on Start Settings, or you can also go to the bottom right corner of the screen and go to the Notification Center, and all settings is there. Any of the ways you can get to settings, and then you go to apps on the main screen, and then default apps. You can scroll down on the right to, they have categories of software for various things like video player, web browser, photo viewer, things like that. And if you click on whatever is showing currently for web browser, it'll bring up a list of all of the installed browsers on your computer, and you can choose any one of them. I wouldn't bother with look for an app in the Microsoft Store. I don't think you'll find any other browser that is a Windows Store app. But you could just go and install other browsers manually, and then they will appear on the list when you go to choose a default web browser and choose anyone you want.
So before we move on, does anybody have any comments on how good Internet Explorer is, or... or how good Edge is? Has anybody used Edge and found it really, really good? And don't forget, you have to unmute your mic if you want to chip in.
One of the things I found cool about the new Edge, they went and took away one of the things, the set-aside tabs, which was one feature that I thought was really, really nice. In the latest version of Edge, which is built on the Chromium engine, they took away that. But they did throw in this other thing called collections. And collections are kind of neat. You can create as many as you want, and you can add to it notes, web pages, documents, all kinds of things into this collection. So if you're researching a particular topic, say vacations, and you could put on web pages to airlines and hotels and cruise lines and car rental places, and you could add in notes when you get prices on various places, and you could put little notes in there, and so you can go to that collection anytime and get all of the information in one location. I thought that was a pretty neat feature of Edge. It's the only one that personally I've found in Edge that is all compelling, but it is pretty neat. Any other opinions?
Hi, this is Gail. I just want to say Internet Explorer is one I use. However, it doesn't work on all sites. So I use Chrome on the sites that don't work with Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
I've never tried Edge. I guess it bugged me that they brought out a new product when they already had one and when they just that one.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Edge now is a completely different animal, though, since the, for about the last month or so, they went live with something that they've had in preview for about a year and a half or 2 years, and that's the Chromium-based Edge. And one of the nice things about Chromium-based Edge is that it will take any of the extensions that are in the Chrome Web Store. So if you're happy with, for example, Google Chrome, and part of the reason is because of all the extensions that are available. All those extensions are now available to you under the new version of Microsoft Edge. So that's kind of nice. They're going to inherit all of the difficulties with the Chromium engine and all of the benefits, and Microsoft is actually feeding in a lot of things into the Chromium engine, enhancements to it and so forth that we're now seeing show up in Google Chrome and so forth as well. So that's kind of neat. But yeah, I use multiple browsers, and as I say, it just depends on the task at hand, what browser happens to work best for me. I only use one for that ends up logged into Facebook. I hate that Facebook tracks you around so much, and so none of my other browsers that I normally use ever log into Facebook. And so I have one browser that if I ever have to go to Facebook, I use it, and that's all I use it for. But there are other reasons as well that I've had for different browsers. Anybody else with an opinion on what they think is a good browser or a bad browser and why?
If I have to go to Facebook, I use my wife's account.
That's a good approach.
Those Facebook icons are still tracking you, and there are a variety of extensions that get rid of them. But for that matter, uBlock Origin and uBlock Matrix and Matrix in particular does a good job of not letting them into any other pages other than the ones you want.
Yeah, Firefox, I figure for me, a lot of it is just not being logged into Facebook ever is going to help somewhat anyways. But
Firefox has a thing called containers that you can set up any number of, and those are basically encapsulate any of the cookies that might be generated during the thing, so that one particular page cannot see the cookies in any other container. That can be useful for things like banking or personal stuff.
A question about the collection that you mentioned in Edge. Is that kind of like Pocket app that's in with Firefox?
I have no idea. I've never used that in Firefox.
Okay. Yeah, you can set up different categories of things for your bookmarks in that app.
I suspect it's more than that because it's not just bookmarks. Okay. Like I say, it allows you to add in notes and documents and all kinds of things can go into a collection.
Interesting.
Yeah, kind of cool.
Okay, our next question stays on the Edge theme. Edge apparently has a setting, continue running background apps when Edge is closed. What does it mean, and should I care? Chris?
This was interesting. When I saw this question come across, I hadn't heard about it at all, and so I Googled about it, and it turns out that it's really not a Microsoft issue. It's a Chromium Engine issue. So this is one of these things where they're inheriting issues that come about because they're using the Chromium Engine for their rendering. And so if you go into Google Chrome, you'll actually find a setting that says continuing running background apps when Google Chrome is closed. So anything that is based on the Chromium Engine is going to have a similar setting, I suspect. And I did a little bit more research onto it to see what it really means, and I came up with the statement: with the new Microsoft Edge, so this is a Chromium-based Edge, extensions, apps, and other services can continue to run in the background even after you close the browser. That means Edge will continue to use your computer's resources. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound very good. When I close down a browser, I want it to be closed down. And so I thought that sounded really, really strange. So I carried on, and I found another reference to it being used with Google Hangouts. So Google Hangouts is video conferencing through Google services. And in a way, it sort of makes sense then. So if you close down the browser, like everything Google does is through a browser. All of their apps run browser, and you know they live and breathe in the browser. And so they want it that your Hangouts is still there if you happen to close down Google Chrome. And so in a way that makes sense. So if Google Hangouts is running as part of the browser process, you don't want Google Hangouts necessarily to shut down when you close down the browser. So okay. If you have an app that is running that is part of the browser process, I think that that's in most cases what it's all about. And if that's the case, it probably would be desirable process to or thing to happen on your browser, I guess. And then I thought, well, on the other hand, if you really understood that Google Hangouts is part of the browser, you would understand that closing down your browser is going to close down any hope of having a Google Hangout request or whatever continue on. So in my particular circumstances, I would think that it would be nice to actually be able to shut those things down as well. And it could save memory, CPU, battery life if you're on a laptop, if you turn that feature off. So if you go into the settings, you can turn it off, so that all of those processes that are started as part of the browser session will close down when you close down the browser. So it's your choice.
As well as Hangouts, it's also useful for Google Calendar for any notifications that you want.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, I didn't think about that. That sort of makes sense. But on the other hand, again, it's just like, you know, I use Google Chrome as my main browser, and it just stays open. But yeah, if you're in the habit of closing down the browser and you still want to be able to get calendar notifications, yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah. Makes sense.
Okay, the next question deals with black screen and needing to hold the power down to force a computer shutdown. And the point was, in Windows 7, that resulted in a lot of warning messages when you booted back up. In Windows 10, you just see a message that the thing's shutting down. And is this sufficient, I guess? And is there a potential for damage to critical files?
NTFS has gotten a lot better, and it's probably pretty safe for any NTFS drives.
Yeah, overall, I think NTFS being a journaling file system, it should be safe. Then again, I mean, any time that you just unceremoniously power something off, there is always the potential for some kind of corruption to occur. And it could even be just that, you know, documents that you had in memory, you lose everything since the last change. I don't know. There could be some things. But, you know, in my experience with this failure to shut down, over the many years, and so it may have changed with Windows 10, I haven't really researched this recently, it usually was caused by drivers. And so drivers are pieces of software that talk to hardware, and they run at a very low level in the operating system. And if you have a very a misbehaving driver, it could definitely cause problems with Windows not being able to shut down properly. It could also be, and I did a little bit more research on this over the last few days, it could be some people saying some of your regular programs not shutting down properly. Now, in most cases, if it's a program that's not shutting down properly, you'll actually see that when you try to do a shutdown. It'll say such and such program is preventing Windows to shut down, and you can say, yeah, shut down anyways, in which case Windows will just kill the process, or you can cancel and go back into Windows and interact with that program that is refusing to allow Windows to shut down. It could be as simple as a document that has changed contents, and so it's sitting there waiting to see if you want to save the changes. So I don't think that that's really common. Someone suggested that if you have programs set to auto start, some of them might not be shutting down properly. So if that's the case, you could run Task Manager and on the Startup tab, set any that you don't need to disabled and see if the problem goes away. You could set all of them to disabled and then see if the problem goes away.
If this is a black screen, there's a possible hardware problem as well. And I would, as the first step, I would unplug the monitor cable and then plug it in again and see if somehow the monitor is shutting off for some reason.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. I've never thought of that.
Yeah, can I jump in on this? Original problem was that this machine, and I'm talking about you, when I wouldn't come out of sleep mode when I lifted the lid. It is sort of, sometimes it is sort of quickly flash the Microsoft Spotlight thing, then boom, black.
And okay.
Talk to me. Oh, hell, you know, go back down like that. And it's very worrying. So HP Envy, their helpful website, they've got 7 pages of stuff to do or try when you get a black screen, which doesn't inspire much confidence, actually.
Yeah.
I think I have got, no wood to touch around it, it's all IKEA, but anyway, I think I have sorted it with some obscure thing about getting rid of the fast start function on one website. It says, oh, get rid of it, you don't need it.
Yeah, that was one that I came across as well, that some people were saying disabling fast startup could actually cause it. A question there, is your processor, does it happen to be a core Intel Core I processor of a 6th generation?
Seven. i7-10000 or something.
You know. Yeah. Okay, because I know that Intel had a lot of problems with their Skylake, the 6th generation processors, and Microsoft got bitten by this with their initial Surface devices that were running on the Core i6 processors, and specifically with sleep mode. So I was thinking that, but I think that was all cured in the seventh gen, so it wouldn't be that. So it sounds like maybe the fast startup has fixed it for you.
Have you noticed it, so you know, touch wood and all the mystery, but it's just.
I've noticed that there are two different kinds of sleep. I have a laptop, a Dell third generation, closing the laptop lid is less sleepy than actually choosing the power icon and choosing sleep, which might be one consideration. Also, fast startup was most useful when you were using a hard disk as your system disk. And if you're using SSD, it does is just write a whole bunch of Hibernate stuff every time and tends to not kill your SSD, but use up all the write cycles that it has in it. And I would suggest not using fast startup on any system that has an SSD as the OS drive.
Oh, that's interesting, Cyber, yeah.
Okay, well, that's two pluses there then, because I do have an SSD, so.
Yeah.
Well, Tom's there, just a sort of personal aside. Do you recognize this T-shirt, Tom?
Ah, yes, I have one of those. Yes, from the RA Camera Club. I helped run that conference when it was on in Ottawa a few years ago.
Yes, 2003. It's my gardening T-shirt, actually. But anyway. Sorry, guys.
Glad you seem to have gotten it solved.
You had one more thing there, Chris, about leaving it sitting?
Yeah, just the idea that I would, if you do have to force shutdown, I would let it sit for a while just to make sure that you're not actively writing to the disk at the point that you power it off. As Tom said, NTFS is a journaling file system, so it should be able to cope with it, but you're always going to be better off if there's no active writing going on to the drive if you do have to force it.
Yeah, interesting. So a feature, it's a very nice machine, you know, high definition touch screen. I didn't really want that, but the disk activity, it's a tiny little knife.
Be glad you even have that.
Well, yeah. Yes, but I'm used to it seeing flashing here or flashing there. Yes, it's a good point on that, to watch for the light to stop.
Give it time, you know, like
you
just
get a little. You get a little program that flashes a light for disk access in your taskbar if you want.
That's right. True.
But that won't help you in a black screen scenario.
That's true.
Unfortunately, I'm finding more and more models. Now, I happened to switch over to Dell, but every year there seems to be less and less what I like to call idiot lights. And now I'm sort of like, I wish I could give it a better name because an idiot light of showing your hard disk activity is still useful information.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The other thing, one of Hewlett Packard's suggestions is if you can do so, access the RAM card, you know, take it out and reinsert it. That's sort of worrying. But if you can do so, this is a return to the manufacturer unit. It's sealed. You can't change the battery.
Anyway. That's it. And even the new Dells right now, like many laptop manufacturers, they're soldering the RAM.
Well, that shouldn't cause any misconnections, then, should it?
Well, unless the soldering's bad, and then you got a lemon. And,
yeah.
The only thing I was just going to add is that I typically wait 15 minutes, and if nothing has happened in 15 minutes, then hold down the power button for 15 seconds.
This is how the old Win 7 machine had to be treated, actually. I'll leave it go and think for itself for 20 minutes, go and have a coffee and come back, and sometimes it sorted itself out.
Yeah.
What's the best option?
Have people here heard of a program called Zero Patch?
Yes. It's a patching, I'm not sure what the best term to call it because they're a non-for-profit group of individuals that put together patches for unsupported operating systems, including Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008, and they're sometimes your only alternative if you continue to run an older system.
Yeah, but they also work in case Windows is slow with an update. It is obviously you're putting your whole system at its mercy, but it seems to be reliable, and I've only seen good things about it.
Ditto.
There's a link in the chat.
I don't know if I'd want to do it on my commercial systems, but then again, you know, it's as you said, Tom, they've had nothing but good feedback, and so far, knock wood, they're doing an excellent job for the community.
Okay, this next question is a follow-up from Pete. Once he got things working, he had the SSE scan now saying that he had found damaged files and fixed them, which was a novelty for him. Since then, he didn't get any. So does that mean that SSE scan now is just about as good as Restore Point?
Good grief, that's the first time when I've run this command line on last of three or four computers that anything's been found. And I thought it had cured the problem, which it wasn't, because the black screen business came back.
If that's the case, though, System File Checker is what it's actually designed to do, is run by itself, so that if any of the critical system files are damaged, that it will recognize that and replace it with a known good version of the file. So you should actually never need to run System File Checker. But Microsoft does allow you to run it, where it'll check all of the files and make sure that they match up byte for byte with the known good version of the files. But it absolutely is not a useless process, because System File Checker is always working, always checking to make sure that files are okay and replacing damaged files as needed. So the fact that you can run it manually is sort of incidental. It is interesting that it did find a problem, normally it shouldn't find anything, because it's working all the time in the background anyways.
It's working as usual now, then it's not finding anything. So it's
that's good.
I have a recovery batch file or command file that uses System File Checker and DISM and CheckDisk. And I'll put a copy of it in the chat.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with running System File Checker or DISM to check your Windows.
It sometimes gets lost, though, is the problem. And DISM is needed to fix things. That's why we only have one DISM in here. But check disk, and when my computer starts to go a little crazy, I put it aside and run this thing with admin permissions, and mostly it comes back to where it should be.
Yeah.
So far.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay, trying to get into safe mode as an administrator and having to enter a long recovery key, or BitLocker. In Windows 7, it's easy to get into safe mode, and how do I do it in Windows 10?
Well, I ended up entering the 48-digit BitLocker thing, which I was quite surprised had written down somewhere. But anyway, it just seems so convoluted. As I was saying, you know, I mean, I'm in as admin in the admin account. I'm obviously going to do some serious digging if I want to get into safe mode. So why do I have to go through this blooming BitLocker thing?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised.
BitLocker is an interesting program too. I had it on a Windows 8 machine, and it was a T100 portable, which I bricked by doing some Linux stuff, and had to send it back to the factory and had a factory reset, and then I had to reinstall, I had to get Windows going again, and of course, if you follow the instructions, they want you to use a Windows account, and when you do that, it actually, this is in Windows 8, it implements disk encryption with BitLocker. So yeah. I got out of there and just used a regular user ID and password, but I still wanted to get rid of BitLocker. And the problem is there's all kinds of help to tell you how to make it work, but there's very little which tells you how to actually disable it. And it turns out what I had to do was set up an administrator's account using a Microsoft account. So I needed the login credentials for Microsoft. Log on using that account, so I had to use a Microsoft account, and then getting into BitLocker and finding this option, change the device encryption settings, and then going down to device encryption and finding it's turned on, and then there's a button to let me turn it off. But then I had to go have a coffee while the operating system decrypted what it had just encrypted. Now, I don't know whether the same, you have to go through the same bells and whistles and hoops to do that in Windows 10, but that seems like a long process to get rid of BitLocker, especially when BitLocker is not supposed to be available on Windows Home Edition. That's one thing I couldn't figure out.
Yeah, which is on this one anyway, it's Home.
But BitLocker is enabled on your Home Edition?
Yeah, well, I actually put this BitLocker key in to get into safe mode. So it told me.
Okay, well, okay, so my initial thought on this is that accidentally putting BitLocker on your system is like accidentally getting pregnant. I'm not sure I see how you would do it unknowingly, unless someone did it for you, whether it was the store or whatever.
It was Redmond. Redmond did it because I was trying to activate Windows, and they wanted me to use a Microsoft account. Yeah. When I did that, it went to the BitLocker, which doesn't exist on the Home Edition.
So well, that's, that. I didn't, that's the point. I wasn't expecting to have it, actually, but it said you got it.
Yeah. Really,
I got it. Oh, so a free gift. Thank you. Right.
Well, the other side of that coin is that if you ever lose your laptop, you don't have to worry about someone going through its contents.
Yeah, one other thing that's interesting about BitLocker is if you do happen to have it turned on and you're ever prompted for it and you go, well, I didn't know I had it, so I don't have my BitLocker key, then go to your Microsoft, if your machine was logged in using a Microsoft account, if you go with another computer onto and go to your Microsoft account, so accounts.microsoft.com, log in there, and your BitLocker recovery key will almost certainly be there. And mm-hmm. So you can actually recover it that way.
I think that's how I must have got them originally when I sort of started. It was two separate HP machines, and I printed it out from somewhere I had, and they very kindly gave a different ID for the two different machines, so I got the correct BitLocker key for the particular machine. But how I quite got there, I don't know, but it just sort of says, here's your BitLocker key, you know.
Oh. Yeah, I know Microsoft Surface devices all come with BitLocker turned on already.
Well, this is
personally, I prefer not to have the whole drive encrypted. I just have a container encrypted and put anything that I want to keep from prying eyes inside that encrypted container.
Yeah.
It was a bit simple. I just sort of said, it wants a BitLocker key, and I got one and I entered it. So perhaps I should have just said, entered the blank space and see what happened. I probably did, but, you know, just to get into that menu of different ways of booting the machine. I had to put this blooming encryption key in, or I did put it in.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
I never used BitLocker, but from what I understand, Alan, there might be a folder I would like to get some protection. So you can select one folder and have that folder protected and not the rest?
No, I think BitLocker, it's the whole drive or nothing.
Mm, that's
but if you use something like, I think it's Veracrypt, then you can establish one folder and have multiple folders and files inside that one encrypted folder.
Okay.
Yeah, I use Veracrypt.
Okay, next question. Magic Sticks promising to download every photo and video in your computer to an amazing stick. The trouble is they're $40 for the small ones, and so if you've got lots of photos and videos, it could be expensive. So the question is, can you do it using command lines, batch files, or software? I thought this was kind of interesting, so I did a Google search, and I said, well, how do you copy all JPEG files on the computer? And one of the first hits, if you remember last week, where I showed this command to delete all the files that weren't JPEGs, and weren't HTML files, rather. This is kind of a variant of the same command, which basically finds all of the files which are images, PNG, JPEGs, GIFs, and copies them to an external drive. Only problem with that I can see is it's looking for all the files, and it's doing it recursively, so it's going through drive C through every folder and every subfolder, finding all the images and copying them, but it's copying them to one folder on the external drive. So you're going to end up with probably thousands of folders, thousands of files in this one folder, which may or may not be what you want. Another hit suggested using Windows Explorer and using the search box and look for a Boolean string *.png or *.gif, yada yada. And then once they've all been identified in the window, you just select all and then copy them wherever you want to go. Again, you'd copy all the files to one particular location. And that kind of got me thinking, well, clearly it's best if you have your images organized in separate folders in some kind of rational system. But, you know, we don't all do that. So how would you find all of your pictures and do it by folder? And one of the things I thought of, there's probably lots of ways of doing it, was to use everything. Everything is a search engine, standalone search engine. So in this case, I told everything, I just want to know all about the JPEGs. So find all *.jpegs. So I could do the same thing for PNGs and GIFs and things. And one of the neat things about everything is it lets you export. So once you've got this list, you can export it. And one of the options is a CSV file, so a comma-separated variable file. So if I do that, then I can take my CSV file and I can import it into Microsoft Excel or some kind of spreadsheet. And in my case, it's actually picking out a whole bunch of drives. So drive J is an SD card, which I'm using for real-time backup. And it's finding some of the images on drive C, but those will be system things, not mine typically. It's finding images on drive, no, you can't see it on that slide, but drive E is my data file. So what I want to do is I want to I filter. So I hit the filter key, and then I filter the different kind of filters, and I choose contain. And I say, find me all of the paths in column B here which contain *\. In other words, find all of the folders and files that are on my data drive. And then once I do that, now I've got a list of all the files and folders in particular that contain images. The file names are on the left here, folders are in column B. Now on column B, I just remove the duplicates, and I remove the duplicates based on the path. So that will get rid of all the multiple versions of the same thing. And then I'll have a list of just the folders which contain my images. And then I could create a batch file which would copy those folders, folder by folder essentially, to an external drive. So by doing that, I could capture all of the JPEG files, all of the image files, but I could maintain the folder structure. And I'm sure there are lots of other ways of doing that, but that's one of the ways that I thought of. Anybody have any other thoughts on how you might accomplish that?
Xcopy. The Xcopy command, you can reproduce the folder setup and put in, a file format like star.jpg, and it will go through your whole hierarchy of folders and reproduce the folders on your destination disk and copy over the files. I think there are other ones as well that will do something similar.
I was thinking of rcopy, but I haven't used that one enough, but I know it's there. I've had to use it a couple of times. I guess that's the best way to put it.
In the earlier solutions that copied all the files into a single directory, how does it handle it when there's files in different directories that have the same file name? That doesn't append like a bracket one, bracket two, et cetera, to the end of the name, or?
Good question, don't know. It probably asks if you want to overwrite. That would be my guess.
Every time.
Yes, 1,000 times, right? Okay, we have about 5 minutes to go, and that's the end of the prepared questions. So we have two choices. We can either ask if there's anybody else that wants to do anything, or we have a probably 15-minute presentation on Avast, the antivirus software. And what do we want to do, Chris?
Yeah, leave it to me. Yeah. I guess what we could do is if people want to go to, where is it? I just wonder if people can raise their hand. How do you do a raise hand now?
It's in the...
I thought it was in the participant list, but...
you use reaction, I think.
Reactions. Yeah, we could do it that way.
Let me make another suggestion.
Okay.
Let's go to the any other questions. We'll see if there are any. And then we'll let Bob do his Avast thing. And if people don't want to stay for the Avast, then they can just leave the meeting.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, so we're here. So any other questions, any other suggestions? Anybody want to share anything? Other than Bob Walker.
I was just reading that apparently the control panel is going to go away on the future Windows 10.
Yeah, they've been saying that since Windows 8.1 or 8.0. There's still a little bit of functionality that doesn't exist anywhere else. I think BitLocker is one of them, actually. To turn on and off BitLocker, there is not a settings app for that. You have to do it through Control Panel. They've been migrating more and more stuff since the start of Windows 8. They've been moving stuff or duplicating things into the settings app, and they've been slowly taking away some things out of Control Panel, but they're not done yet. I think you'll see Control Panel will be there at least until all functionality has been migrated to the settings app.
You yourself, are you sad to see Control Panel go if it goes?
I don't care. It's just the configuration app. I mean, settings is a configuration app. Control Panel is a configuration app. As long as the functionality is there, I don't care what you call it. Yeah, it's just a way to configure Windows.
It doesn't make sense to have two different...
One comment I saw about that is that, for example, if you are typing system, there's three different ways to see your systems, through the control panel, through the settings, and through another application.
Yeah, Microsoft has always wanted to give you... 50 different ways to accomplish the same thing. I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't really. It doesn't really bother me at all. One thing that is kind of nice in the settings app is that if you're unsure of where something is, if you just type it into the search box there, it will search for things in settings as well as control panel. And so the results will bring you both locations. So if I go now, let me just make sure I'm not talking at my so if I go to settings and I type in BitLocker, the one drop down that happens is manage BitLocker. And if I click on that, it loads control panel, you know, in the all control panel items, BitLocker drive encryption. So it just takes me to the right place. So if you don't know where something is, just type it in the search box in Windows settings, and it'll find it, whether it's in settings or if it's in control panel.
Oops. Can I ask a quick question?
Yep.
Okay, so...
Oh, we had a question there.
Well, actually, it's about what I had written to you, Chris, before. I was just wondering if anyone else has any suggestions aside from, and I don't know how to pronounce it, the EaseUS to do for the AOMEI backup or to back up my system.
Yeah, both of those two programs, as well as the other two that I reviewed, they fundamentally do the same thing. And so they create an image of your system and allow you to recover either a complete image or an individual partition or, indeed, individual files or folders. So they all basically accomplish the same function. You had asked about how old my review was, and those programs, they don't change really quickly. So you'll find that my review is probably pretty darn current in terms of the capabilities and ways the programs operate. You know, do we have an opinion on, you know, what people use? I know, Alan, you use Macrium Reflect Free. I use EaseUS to do backup. I have used AOMEI Backup. Any other opinions on what people think are good image backup programs and why?
I like Macrium because it's free. It's relatively fast. It works. I can restore very quickly. I can mount the image and restore individual files or folders. You don't use it because it doesn't do incremental backups. But I never do incremental backups, so that's not an issue for me.
I actually paid for it, so I could do incremental backups. That's available. I find the incremental backups are useful. The first time I had to recover something, it was fascinating. I wanted to restore a file that I'd overwritten by mistake, and I said, come on, do something. Come on. I was sitting there. It's so fast, it just gone across.
Expecting it to take time.
Yes.
I guess of the programs that I mentioned in the review, Macrium, the only one that doesn't that has any sort of deficiency is the Macrium Reflect Free, and that it's just that it doesn't do incrementals. You have to pay for the program if you want to be able to do incrementals. So incrementals can allow you to run very, very quick backups. On my system, a full backup will take probably about 2.5 hours, and the incremental backups typically run in about 3 minutes. I run them every night. So incremental backups can be really, really nice. All the other three programs that I talked about, they even the free versions, do incremental backups as well. So if you want incremental backups, that would be one reason to not go with Macrium Reflect, not because it's a bad program, but just because the free version doesn't offer that feature. All the other ones, very, very similar in their capabilities.
And the user friendliness.
Yep. Yeah, they're all pretty straightforward, and they all have user guides that are available that can walk you through step-by-step, you know, doing your backups and doing recoveries and things like that.
Okay.
It's my memory, but I thought an earlier version of Macrium Free did have incremental, because it's sort of, in my mind, I've always had incremental, and I haven't always paid for it.
Oh. Okay, it might have been in the past, but for quite a few years, it's been only full backups.
I'm talking probably 4 or something like that.
But just to mention, my full backup takes about 12 minutes, so it's not an issue. Okay, so the next Q&A is going to be next week, so if you have any questions, send them to the suggestion box. But in the meantime, if you're interested, we have a presentation by Bob Walker on his recent experiences with Avast, the antivirus software product. So, Bob, it's now time for you to share your screen.
And he is. Oh, sorry, that was the last slide. Okay.
Okay.
Oh, this Bob.
Down at the bottom middle, you should have a share screen there, Bob.
Okay, hang on just a second here. Yeah, I hit the share screen. Oh, here we go.
Well, you have to hit share as well.
Okay.
Okay, you're sharing your whole desktop. You can share just the PowerPoint window if you want it instead, but...
There we go.
Okay.
Okay, so I've been using Avast antivirus software for quite a while, and I've used some of their other products as well. I'm generally fairly happy with the products, but there's some issues in that, and I've in the last few weeks, I found a couple things that might be of interest to everybody. So Avast is a Czech cybersecurity software company. They have almost half a billion monthly active users, and they have the second largest market share in, after Symantec with their Norton products. Avast acquired AVG a few years ago, and originally AVG products were going to be marketed separately, but now they're being merged into the Avast product line. Avast's main product is the Avast Antivirus, but they also have other tools such as Avast Secure Browser, Avast Cleanup, and Avast SecureLine VPN. This is a graph of the market share. Symantec is number one, and Avast is fairly close behind. Their biggest product is the Avast Free Antivirus. The free version accounts for something like 90 to 95% of their antivirus market. The basic free antivirus, it blocks viruses and other malware. It scans your Wi-Fi for security weaknesses, and it has a sort of weeny password manager that's pretty mediocre. If password management is a big priority for you, there's better things, including Avast's own paid-for version than the one that comes with the free antivirus. The free antivirus is supported by advertising, so you get a certain amount of that pipe through you. And the free antivirus is also available in iPhone and Android versions for your smartphone. Their premium antivirus generally costs $80 a year for one device or $100 a year for 10 devices in Canada. It adds to the free antivirus by avoiding fake sites for safer shopping. It's sort of an anti-phishing function. You can run suspicious apps in a sandbox, so it won't affect your whole machine. It has a good firewall. You can block annoying spam and phishing emails. There's a layer of ransomware security. You can put a wall around certain folders and folder trees that it can't be locked in by ransomware. You can stop your webcam from being used against you inadvertently, and you can permanently shred sensitive files. And there's an app updater there that will automatically update all your other applications. The Avast antivirus is one of the top-rated products, but it's important to read the reviews and to see the strong and weak points of the various products and compare them to your own needs. For example, these are the top four choices here from PC Magazine, and it gives the strengths of each one. In Avast case, it's the best for its wealth of bonus features, whereas AVG is best for a few frills protection. So you want to have a look at what the strengths are of the various products. Avast is known primarily for its antivirus products, but it has several other products that might be of interest. In their privacy products, they have the SecureLine VPN product, and that encrypts your connection to maintain privacy. And it's especially important if you go onto public networks like at Tim Hortons or Starbucks or elsewhere, and or when you do online banking. In my opinion, the Avast VPN is better than NordVPN, but it's quite a bit more expensive. Also note that you can use a VPN to put you in another country to bypass access restrictions, but sites like Netflix can detect you using a VPN and may block access anyway. Avast also has an anti-track product that prevents third parties from tracking your browsing activity. Some of the other anti-trackers just try and block the tracking, in which case you can break some websites or whatever, and they don't work very well. The Avast anti-track actually feeds fake data to the trackers, so they're not seeing your true digital fingerprint. And it also automatically deletes tracking cookies and other tracking data. So it does a good job, but it's very expensive, $65 a year for one PC. And if you want just an anti-tracker blocker, there's some good freeware versions available out there, and I've given the website here so you can go for some reviews. Avast also has their own browser, a secure browser, and it focuses on internet security and privacy. It's based on the Chrome browser engine, so given how Google makes all their money from monetizing your personal data, I don't know how good a Google Chrome-based browser engine is going to be in as far as being secure. And then there's the Avast Passwords, which is a more capable password manager than the one that comes with Avast Free. They also have some other performance products. There's the Cleanup Premium, and it's one of a number of products that different companies have to increase the speed and performance of your computer. However, there's some real caveats with this. You want to use caution when you're using these things, especially using any of the register repair functionality. And this goes for all of the performance enhancing software. And you also want to be careful with some of the browser cleaning and other things they do, because it can wipe out all your caches with all your gaming records on it, so that you're on level 12 of some complex game and all that information is gone. So you have to be very careful using these products, because they can cause more problems than they solve sometimes. Avast also has a driver updater that automatically updates your drivers. However, I do not recommend using any third-party driver updaters. Windows Updates does a good job of this already, and the driver updaters sometimes use non-standard drivers that can cause problems. So I just leave it up to Windows to keep your drivers up to date. And Avast also has a battery saver function for your laptops and tablets and that. I've never used this, so I don't know whether it actually helps extend your battery life or not. Avast also has a product called Avast Family Space that gives you parental controls for your kids' iPhones and Android phones. So you can control who they're chatting with, how much time they spend browsing. If they're going to any inappropriate content, you can limit their ability to do that. So it gives you some peace of mind. And as far as I've been able to figure out, this product is free. You just go to the Avast website and download it. Or go to your Google Store or Apple Store. One of the problems with Avast is they're always trying to upsell you on stuff. You know, you start with a free antivirus and it keeps on pestering you to get the paid for version. You use the paid for version, or the paid for version of Avast cleanup, and they tell you about a problem. When you click on the resolve button, it'll try to upsell you to one of their other products to fix the problem. So, and they're always adding new little products on to keep you lined up there, buying more and more from them. Now, Avast bundles a lot of their products. One of the problems I had until recently was the Avast paid-for antivirus came in a single license or a three-device license. And if you had five or six machines to take care of, you had to buy three license packs. They've changed that recently. So you have a single product or a single license or a 10 device license. And the 10 device price is only 20 to 40% over the single license price. So if you have like 8 or 10 devices, you know, your family, everybody has their own laptops and smartphones and everything, the bundles aren't a bad deal. They also have an Avast Ultimate bundle, which gives you the Avast Premium Antivirus, their Cleanup Premium, the SecureLine VPN, and the Premium Passwords, which is their deluxe version of their password app, for about 40% more than Avast Premium Antivirus by itself. However, the Avast Ultimate bundle does not include the Avast Anti-Tracker. It seems the Anti-Tracker is only available in Canada in standalone single license packages. And like I mentioned before, it's about $65 a license. This is a table of the features and Canadian pricing for the antivirus and the Avast Ultimate. The summary is right here is the single license for premium security is $80 a year. If you get a 10 device license, it's $100 a year. If you get the ultimate package, single license, it's $120 a year. And if you get the 10 device ultimate package, it's $140 a year. And it's all by a subscription basis. So it's not software, you just buy and you own it forever. There's been some controversy. Apparently, it was reported in January that Avast sells every search, every click, every buy on every site to all sorts of corporate customers. They sell that information through their JumpShot subsidiary. In response,
I think we just lost Bob. It looks like his battery decided to quit.
So his internet connection might have gone away on him too. He was having a little bit of buffering problems. Let's just see if he comes back. But I think he was almost done anyways.
I just mentioned that I was using Avast on my smartphone, and I did run into those pop-up ads and selling and all that kind of nonsense. So I just got rid of it. And I've been using Sophos. They have for the phone, it's a product called Intercept X for mobile, and it's an antivirus, free antivirus, which works in the background most of the time. You never know it's there, but it seems to do a real good job.
Yeah, I use it on my phone as well. Quite happy with it. Okay, I don't see Bob coming back, so
Well, we can do a follow-up next week.
Yeah, that's true. We can have the final part of his presentation. Okay, I guess that's it, folks. So we will be putting up the recording and the PDF of the deck on the website, so expect that in a few days. And outside of that, we will see you next Wednesday night for Q&A, I hope. So have a good evening. Have a good week.
Okay.
Oh.
I'm back. Sorry about that. I was outside on the deck there, and it seems my battery went.
Okay. Off. You are back to being co-host if you wanted to wrap up your presentation.
Okay. I'm almost done anyway, so let me.
Okay.
Okay, so Avast got caught selling their data through their subsidiary. So in response to this, they've gotten rid of their subsidiary, and they've promised to stop doing this. But on the basis of that, because they are a Czech company, the Czech Office of Personal Data Protection, and data protection is very strong in the European Union. Is investigating Avast because of all this. Okay, so you have a lot of choices here. There are free or freemium, which is basically you start with the free version, they try and upsell you, and or paid for versions of any of the Avast products available from other companies. It's up to you to do the research and study the reviews to determine which of these products from what companies are best meet your needs. I found the Avast products do what I need them to do for the most part, or whatever. And Windows 10 has some of these functionalities built in, including Windows Defender. And I know Chris is a strong defender of Defender.
Yes, indeed.
If your internet activity is pretty vanilla, then Windows Defender might meet your antivirus, anti-phishing, anti-malware requirements all by itself. However, if you use Facebook or other social media a lot, if you're involved in any human rights or protest activities, especially anything related to China, like Tibet or Hong Kong, the Chinese are looking for you, and they're state-sponsored cyber terrorism. If you download pirated music, movies, etc., if you go to adult websites or any other potentially risky behavior, then you probably should use some sort of additional anti-virus, anti-phishing, anti-malware products besides just Windows Defender. No single antivirus product is going to catch all the threats. Some are better than others at catching threat signatures. Which is, a known threat thing, and others are better at identifying new threat behavior. And the capabilities of any given product wax and wane compared to other products over time. So, for example, Norton Antivirus was the first big name in antivirus products, and they were pretty good because they were, one of the few products. Over time, they got overtaken by other companies, and they've since made a big comeback, so... this all goes back and forth over time, so you have to keep an eye out for that. If you look at any of last year's reviews or reviews from the year before, they're probably no longer valid. You want to look at the latest versions of any kind of reviews. But keep in mind that if you have two or more products doing real-time scans on the same computer, they'll generally conflict with each other. However, if you use a second product like Malwarebytes to do a standalone scan from time to time, that can be useful because it'll catch different things than whatever your other, the one product may catch different things than the product you're using daily. So, and Windows Defender is the one sort of product in this space that's designed to play nice with the other antivirus products. So, you install any of the antivirus products over top of Windows Defender, Windows Defender will sort of take a bit of a back seat, but it'll still be active to a certain extent. And that's all there is.
Yeah, the one thing I could add for the way Windows Defender works is if you install something else, Windows Defender, it never gets uninstalled because it is built into Windows, but it will run a periodic on-demand scan, which is kind of neat because it's just like a double check on anything that your antivirus might be missing. So it just runs. I think it's a weekly thing that it'll run in the background. Okay, anything before we wrap up for the night? Okay, thanks very much all for attending and participating, and thanks, Bob, for the presentation, and we'll see you all next week.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.